my head. Oh, if you're a regulator out there or a politician in a current position to do something about it, please make notes from this podcast. And I'm going to include a lot of the notes that we're discussing in the show notes below. Welcome, everyone, back to another episode of Lockdown Toronto. I really appreciate you tuning back in. This week, we touch on this topic of misinformation, COVID-19 in the Canadian context, and not just limited to that, but also limited to, or also involving how misinformation involving COVID-19 has real-world consequences on the ground. And to broach the subject with us, I bring on Angus Bridgman, who co-authored a study. He's a political scientist out of McGill University, co-authored a study on misinformation in the Canadian context and its connection to the consequences for society. And I'm really excited to touch on this topic because it's really relevant. We're seeing a lot of the anti-mask protests happening, and I welcome to the show Angus. Angus, welcome.
Thanks for having me. Nice to be here.
Okay, so I came across your study because it got a bunch of press. A study that you co-authored with your colleagues, and I found it incredibly interesting for a bunch of reasons. But before we go into that, can you just run us through what the study was about and its basic conclusions?
Yeah, for sure. So this was a study published in the Harvard Misinformation Review, which is sort of a new journal looking at broadly the misinformation phenomenon, interdisciplinary, looking at psychology, political science, communications. Our study was sort of really interested in the Canadian misinformation ecosystem. So there's been a lot of good academic work and a lot of the discourse on this has come out of the United States, but as can often happen in Canadian politics, things get overshadowed, and we really wanted to understand the Canadian context. So we knew that there was misinformation circulating online, but what we wanted to really understand was, to what extent was misinformation circulating? How does it compare across different media forms? So those who get primarily their news from social media versus traditional media, are they more or less exposed to misinformation? And then really key is not just to sort of count the amount of misinformation, but to say, okay, given this misinformation, how do attitudes and behaviors change in response to it? And so we were trying to sort of draw that link very clearly from misinformation circulating online, exposure to that misinformation, and then maybe some changed attitudes and beliefs. So what we found was relative to sort of traditional media, there was significantly more misinformation circulating on social media. Here, empirically, we looked specifically at Twitter, but I can talk a little bit about the other social media platforms later. There was a lot more on Twitter, both discussion of it, just sort of saying yes, this is, or propagating the misinformation and combating it. Mm-hmm. There was a lot more on social media. And then people who sort of self-report consuming a lot of social media had far greater misperceptions around COVID-19 and were far less likely to engage in sort of like safe social distancing behaviors. So we kind of draw that link quite clearly. And I think this is sort of like an important brick in this wall that's being built, trying to say, look, social media companies, what's happening on your platforms is highly consequential for real world behaviors, and people are getting killed because of it.
So in terms of that, and those who watched the last episode will understand what I'm talking about here in the sense of you allude to real world consequences. And to be clear, that's, you know, the anti-mask movement is probably the best manifestation of that. In Montreal, for example, we saw thousands in the streets protesting the mask protocols and social distancing and just general demonstrating general anti-government attitudes. Is that part of the consequences we're talking about?
Yeah. So there's that initial kind of visible mass demonstration element, but the number of people that attend those sorts of demonstrations is relatively small, sort of the tip of the iceberg. So, I mean, we didn't look at the protest movements in this study. We looked at amongst the full population. And depending on your estimate, depending on what you're looking at, you know, 25-30% of Quebecers, Canadians have quite strong misperceptions about COVID-19. That's a huge number. And most of those people are not going out to protest,
right?
But they are there. there are very large Facebook groups that have popped up around COVID misinformation in the Canadian context. For example, there's a Quebec one against the wearing of masks that has about 25,000 members now. That's quite new. I'm a member there, and it's got, you know, 120, 130 posts a day. These are people who are incredibly active and feel very passionately about what they're arguing, but ultimately are arguing against a public health recommendation that can have potentially deadly consequences for themselves and their fellow citizens.
And I mean, just even to touch on that a little bit, if we are to draw some of these correlations and connections between social media consumption and real world consequences and behavioral changes. Just looking at Quebec, I mean, Quebec has just over half the population of Toronto, or sorry, of Ontario, and they have, by last count, 61,000 cases of COVID-19 versus Ontario's, which is hovering around 40,800. Do you think, first of all, what is it about Quebec that why the virus spread more prevalently, and two, why it seems that the anti-mask movement or those kinds of Facebook groups are not very specific, but more specific to the Quebec context?
That's like a huge question. You ask a social scientist that question, they go, okay, whoa, we need to like talk about so many different things.
I've got all day, and I would love to go deep into it, because I'm an Anglophone and we're in Toronto, and obviously we look at it through a lens of curiosity a little bit, right?
So yeah. So I think that, and there will be, you know, a report written on this that really kind of explores this well, but the cities, the places in the world that were initially the worst affected by COVID-19 were the places with the large international airports that saw a lot of travel. I mean, I'm originally from Winnipeg. Mm-hmm. And there were until recently almost no cases. They had a long period of no cases. There's been a bit of a resurgence. There is an international airport in Winnipeg, but there's not very many people kind of coming through that. It's no surprise that the three sort of major outbreaks at the beginning of the pandemic in Canada were Vancouver, Toronto, Montreal.
Right.
In the Quebec context, there were a couple factors, notably seniors' homes, which there was a massive spread, massive death in the Quebec context. And the exact reason for that is tricky, but there's a large population in Quebec that winters in Florida. Mm-hmm. You know, we can't lay the blame solely there, and there will be sort of an investigation into this, but a lot of them were coming back to Quebec, were exposed to people all across sort of that side of the United States coming back, and it's very possible that there was a lot picked up there. You had a few super spreader events early on, in several weddings that, you know, before we really had a good handle on this, before there were social distancing measures in place, this allowed the virus to spread throughout the population quite quickly. I think that people should be less certain about like attributing cultural differences to the reasons that a COVID outbreak happens one place or another. Right. I think a counterexample is the United States, where clearly the severity of the pandemic there has been related to like political and cultural factors. Mm-hmm. But in the Canadian context, the rates are different, but there is a there's a large degree of chance in this, and the public policy response can be effective, but only to a limited degree. And ultimately people's personal decisions are consequential for that. And so I guess that sort of brings us back to what we're talking about today in terms of sort of a strong resistance to social distancing measures.
Yeah.
And it's not that the rates in Quebec are particularly high relative to the rest of the country. That's not, I wouldn't draw that link very directly.
Right.
And the case rate now in Quebec versus the rest of Canada is not significantly different. The ongoing cases.
No, it's not.
There was that higher peak for sure.
Yeah. It's well within the range of what's happening in Ontario. I mean, everything's kind of normalized out.
Alberta now.
Yeah. Exactly. And okay, so I'm not trying to rag on Quebec in this context, but you mentioned those fairly large Facebook groups. And is that something unique to that province? Are they specific to the Quebec context, or are they Canada-wide Facebook groups?
Absolutely not. The Facebook groups are like an interesting feature that rolled out in 2017 and have seen wide use by like a whole number of actors, but there are a large number of anti-science, low trusting groups across a whole range of issues on Canadian Facebook, many private but many public, and they exist all across the country. And yes, there's been some kind of high profile groups in Quebec, but again, it's not different than what we see in Ontario or in the rest of Canada. One of the things that we really emphasize in the study, which I think is sort of important to note here, is that people's sort of vulnerability to misinformation and to absorbing that and becoming misinformed, and that process is not unique to a particular educational group or cultural background. That's a human vulnerability,
right?
And we can talk about some of the psychological mechanisms underpinning that. But there's a recent poll that came out yesterday in Quebec, which showed that healthcare workers had higher misperceptions than the general population.
What?
Which is around 5G. So 5G propagation of COVID-19.
So the 5G and the COVID-19 link among health professionals, there's a greater adoption of misinformation or
the rate is something like, forgive me if the numbers are slightly wrong, but it's something like 6% in the general Quebec population and something like 13% in the healthcare population. This is based on surveys. And so the margin of error is large, but sort of, and I haven't looked at the underlying study, but that just came out yesterday. And so
it's
like, this
still
is
notable. It's still notable difference.
Yeah.
Do you think that's because they are around, let's put it this way. Do you think because they are health professionals, they're around discussions or belong to groups or social media groups that involve healthcare discussions generally, or maybe the algorithm tags them as people being interested in that topic and therefore they might be exposed to it? Could it be kind of the tail wagging the dog in that sense?
Yeah, that's a really interesting hypothesis, actually, and something that would be worth looking into, whether or not health professionals are more exposed to this information on their social media. And thus, one of the things we find is like repeat exposure to misinformation breeds familiarity, and familiarity breeds belief, or at least doubt, in mainstream scientific opinion. And so that very easily could be what is happening. I suspect that it's
well, great. When you do that study, you can add me as a co-author for the suggestion.
Yeah, there you go. Definitely, we'll write it together. The healthcare professional category. I'm curious. Again, this is sort of a definitional category. These aren't all doctors, right? This is a whole range of healthcare professionals, and we have seen in the last several decades. I mean, it's been a persistent phenomenon, but like alternative medicine increasing. So this is a whole range of quote unquote medical practitioners that might already be predisposed to strong questioning of like mainstream medical belief. So, people who regularly treat with acupuncture, and I think acupuncture can be effective in some cases. You know, I don't know.
You're being
I don't know
kind.
The science. Yeah,
You're
I don't know
being
the science.
Very kind.
Fair enough. I don't know the science well behind it, but that acupuncturist used to treat things that traditional or sort of contemporary medicine is ineffective for might lead to greater doubt in, you know, medical expertise. And so that might be an association there. But I expect you have to do like some really detailed investigation into this population to answer that question well.
Yeah, for sure. And just to touch on that a little bit, the idea of exposure to misinformation. So personally, just talking from my personal experience, I run a VPN. I only browse in private mode most of the time on my phone and on my computer. I have a container on my Facebook, so a container plugin, so it doesn't track me around the web. There are a bunch of measures that if I see a link on one of my social media feeds that I find interesting, I never click on it. I'll copy paste that into another browser, just to ensure that my media diet remains as pure as possible. And even then, I can tell that the algorithm, just based on my location, my age, my gender, my other, maybe other factors, my friend groups even, it's already pegging me into a category and feeding me certain information. Now, if that's happening to me, and I go to those lengths, the regular population has zero chance of beating this or even being conscious of it in a way where they're being thrown into a bubble, thrown into an advertising bubble, for example. How does one combat that kind of media, the serving of that kind of information, deliberate serving of that information to them, when a lot of it involves, or a good chunk of it can involve misinformation?
So there is, what you're talking about there is like advertising misinformation. And I'm not saying that that doesn't exist. For sure that does exist. And people will be exposed to that through Facebook ads or Google ads. But there is some degree of filtration happening there, where there is some of these social media companies are trying to reduce that. I think that that is for sure a problem. And we can talk about like media conglomeration and what that does to the health of like the internet and the information ecosystem overall. But actually, I think what's happening is not the advertising part. It's often social networks. And that's primarily what's going on. We have a really strong tendency to trust those we believe in. And you log into Facebook and your friend from back in high school is repeatedly like posting this thing, and you might block them, but then another friend starts doing it, and you know, it just keeps going. You're on Twitter and you know, somebody retweets something, even if it's just to expose it, and suddenly you start to get curious. You're on YouTube. I think YouTube is one of the main sources in our study, finds that, you know, misperceptions are very strongly associated with YouTube use. The recommended videos, anyone who and I'm sure you've got some Joe Rogan fans here, but you know, if you spend enough time on YouTube, you're going to get shown Joe Rogan. And if you get shown Joe Rogan, there's a litany of, you know, free thinkers, I think they would style themselves as, that have been guests on his show and have really opened the door for many into kind of this world. So I think it's less about, there is some push content, but there's mm-hmm. also some opt-in element here, which is very powerful, and I think doing a lot of the work.
So it's basically people saying, hey, there might be something to this, because more than one friend or whatever, essentially they're seeing a legitimacy, they're feeling a legitimacy around a certain type of information because certain friend groups share it, and that is in some ways more powerful than what's being fed to them on their timeline through advertising algorithms or, traditional media. And that's another thing I want to touch on. In your study, you talk about how traditional media diet consumption of media diet of traditional media versus social media, that there's an acute distinction there. Can you explain and walk us through that a little bit?
Yeah. So there's two elements to this. One is that we went through and identified every news article across 19 publications published during the period of interest, mm-hmm. and we read each of them and we coded each of them for misinformation. So we had two coders go through and do that. Very little misinformation was circulating on traditional media. There was some mentions of it, and I'll get to the mentions piece in a second, because I think actually the mentions piece is a very important part of the story. But there's low misinformation circulating on traditional media, at least sort of the large like press outlets in the Canadian context. There's a number of reasons why that might be, but let's say there's low misinformation. Then we looked at sort of the survey respondents that we did, and you know, where they were getting their media from, and people who were getting their media primarily from traditional media had many fewer misperceptions, were more likely to engage in social distancing behaviors, et cetera. So there was sort of that strong link. And I think like one of the reasons this got so much media attention is it's like media catnip. I mean, like traditional media good, social media bad,
yep.
COVID, misinformation. I mean, you yep. couldn't write a better piece for media to be
all
over
the editors
it, right?
Woke up that morning and say, this is front page.
Jackpot. You know, and that's fair. But I think that there is something really important, like a broader theme here, which is really important, which is that traditional media, for all its numerous faults, and we can talk about you know, enormous problems that are is facing traditional media today, and some of their own culpability in sort of generating these problems. But they have to a real extent an editorial team. They have efforts to make sure that they are fact checked. You know, they do multiple sources. I've worked with media a lot. There is really a goodwill effort to attempt to only circulate information that they have.
You forgot one part there. There's also lawyers who tell them.
And there's lawyers. Yeah. That's true. I mean, so
in
journalistic
sense,
integrity
they're risk averse to lawsuits.
Liability.
They're risk averse to liability. Yeah. I mean, and that's a real thing. And I think that is a connective tissue that it's not often touched on. I mean, when people spread misinformation online, they're usually linking to real world truth, eyeopener/whatever.com and an article posted on there that has, you know, 5,000 pop-ups for supplements, right? And again, we're talking about advertising-driven stuff. There is an advertising-driven component to some of this stuff. There's a profit motive. I mean, when the eyeballs and the clicking, but when you go to see who owns that website, it's, you know, it's registered in Guam or something, you know, like you'll never find a legal liability link anywhere in that for that misinformation. And I think that is a very strong component and an incentive for people with nefarious goals or profit motives to just propagate this stuff. Is that not the case? And is that not the case in some of the stuff you found?
I mean, this research didn't speak specifically to that, but yeah, it's well documented that particularly in the American context where sort of consumption of political news is enormously high, that there were a whole number of websites, for-profit websites set up just to drive clicks that perpetuated and propagated misinformation during the 2016 election, and similar in UK during Brexit. So this is well documented. This is fact that these websites exist. And I mean, in the one of the things I think that is somewhat different about the COVID-19 stuff is that there have been and there are prominent doctors, politicians, sort of advocating or perpetuating misinformation, you know, with their names on things. And so that legal liability argument is a very interesting thing. But like, I think the hydroxychloroquine debate that is largely settled or is settled by mainstream sort of science. They have done randomized controlled trials on this and they have found no effect. Mm-hmm. There is still this large population. And I've sort of taken time to find sort of a few groups on Facebook and a few people on Twitter to follow. And there is an enormous response, an enormous like perpetuation of sort of hydroxychloroquine with zinc and blah, 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 in the face of all sort of peer-reviewed, rigorous scientific evidence. And so people are putting their name on it, but there is sort of maybe a plausible deniability that, you know, like this worked in our practice. And you would think that this would lead to medical malpractice suits or to real issues of liability, but it doesn't seem to be the case, at least so far.
Why do you think that is? Do you think just people are waiting for the dust to settle a little bit on it? Or is it just, I don't know.
I think there is also just, there is a real slowness to science, a frustrating, deeply irritating slowness to science and to certainty that happens. I think there is going to be a generation of people who will remember that the government did not recommend masks and then mandatorily recommended masks or required masks. That switch will have done more harm to public trust in science and public trust in government than almost any other action taken by governments. And the frustration with that is about a misunderstanding of the scientific process, which is to say, at the beginning, there was not an understanding that this was sort of an aerosol, air-transmitted virus. As scientific understanding progressed, okay, masks do help in the prevention. We are now recommending masks. This is how public policy should be. This is what we want, actually. Mm-hmm. It's frustrating that that wasn't the recommendation and that we didn't know that from the beginning, but it's a new virus with elements like previous ones, but elements that are different. And so that frustration is somewhat misplaced. this science and the particularly medical science is an ongoing endeavor. And so, you know, just some patience and some humility there and going, okay, people did a study. They thought it might work. It didn't work. Let's try something else. And that openness to that sort of scientific process is very low, yeah. I think, amongst sort of conspiracy-minded people. This is a, you know, a secret cabal.
Well, I mean, I agree with you 100% on that. But to the credit of the general public, there has been some level of malfeasance, even intentional malfeasance, on the part of government officials and world health experts. And I always point to the example of Taiwan. Taiwan, I actually returned from Taiwan on March 15th, and I saw exactly on the ground how they dealt with it. And they are the gold standard when it comes to dealing and containing the coronavirus. And the reason they are is because they ignored China and ignored what China was saying and did their own investigations. They were ringing the alarm bells early on in this process, saying that it's highly transmissible. When China was denying that it was, the World Health Organization freezed them out consistently throughout this process, because of at the behest of China. It's been quite obvious. The World Health Organization has been taking a lot of their cues from this, from what China said, and not necessarily what the investigations. For all the faults that have happened, there has been a political and malicious layer to this on some level when it comes to that part of it, right? I mean, I'm not saying the World Health Organization is some evil organization, but there has been some political interference that has contributed to some level of public mistrust, even on my own part. I'm very pro-science, and I'm very all about the evidence, and I'm all about the facts, and I'm all about following where the evidence goes. But it's quite undeniable that on some level, the World Health Organization has dropped the ball on this because of their ties and their sensitivities towards the Chinese-Taiwanese context. Do you have any comment on that at all? Or
I mean, you know, I've read the same, I think, summaries of this and arguments around this. And it's very clear that the reaction was slow and that China initially completely obfuscated the severity of the virus, and the World Health Organization did follow their lead. Yeah. And that will hopefully never be repeated. And that there was a good faith belief that, you know, in the global interests of virus containment, that there would not be that level of dishonesty.
Yeah.
But there was, and you know, in some ways we got suckered.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that's fair. I think that can be true, but it can also be true that the government is doing its best and is trying to follow the scientific evidence, and
which I also agree with.
Yeah. Is taking, you know, where it can. I think one of the things that really strikes me about conspiracy thinking, and particularly, you know, anti-COVID-19 misinformation, is this like real desire for a simplicity. And I think this gets into like some underlying psychological mechanisms around belief in conspiratorial thinking. But we like to have a coherent version of the world. And this coherent version of the world is like internally consistent. And one of the things that I know, kind of going through the academic publishing process, working a lot with media, working with governments, is that the world is incredibly complicated. And like simple explanations are never right. Like very clear, simple, like there is a global conspiracy to suppress X. The scientific community is incredibly dispersed, incredibly decentralized. And in order for a conspiracy to be consistent across, you know, like, let's take hydroxychloroquine, like the number of people that would need to be in on that conspiracy and the number of people who would have to compromise their professional ethics and compromise their like understanding of the scientific process is immeasurable. And, you know, like to believe that is to believe in a world that is run by a small group of people that is so beyond any social scientist's understanding of how the world actually works and the chaos and the human eccentricity that actually occurs. And so I think that that desire for simplicity drives a huge amount of this thinking. And so this, you know, the simple explanation is sometimes right. You know, China suppressed information about the spread of the virus and convinced the World Health Organization that it was not deadly, and so it got propagated. That can be true. But everything since then, you need to sort of update. You know, we're not living in February anymore or March.
Right.
And in order for the scientific community to keep up, sort of these longstanding health ruses is so, you know, it's absurd. It's absurd.
So can we get into the psychology of why conspiracy, other than people wanting a simplistic worldview? So earlier, I mean, we had a pre-discussion a little bit about this, but you touched on the idea that the people susceptible to this, the misinformation, there is really no demographic acute point where, you know, it's this kind of group. Is there any age connection, location, geography, urban, rural? Are there any kind of cleavages there?
Cleavages is strong because cleavage, you know, is two different groups. Yes, people who are older and consume a lot of social media are more vulnerable. Absolutely, right? I mean,
Is that because they didn't grow up with the internet and they don't understand the pitfalls of following click holes?
They also have a lot more time on their hands to consume news. And this is like another kind of, you know, you might think it's age, but actually it's free time where, you know, you can go down a YouTube rabbit hole. Yes, there are groups that are more susceptible. Like in the United States, those on the right tend to have far stronger misperceptions around COVID-19. In the Canadian context, there's some relationship, but it's a lot smaller. So there are differences, but consistently, no one, not even people with sort of like a strong understanding of science, is immune to this effect, which is like repeat exposure to misinformation cast doubt. Yeah. I think like a good example for listeners might be like 5G conspiracy theories. Like, I had an abstract idea of what 5G was. Like, you know, I understand the way, like in a general, like high school physics sense of like how this works. But you hear this 5G, and I'm like, what are people talking about 5G? And sort of you go a few weeks, and you keep hearing it, and then you start to, like, you can't help it. You're like, okay, there's something going on. Like, what is going on with 5G? Why is this? And then you hear that, okay, so it's a Chinese company doing it. You know, they're kind of sketch, like, or, you know, what's going on? So you really start to get concerned. And, like, I'm a scientifically literate person, and I just hadn't taken the time to sit down and go, okay, what is 5G? What is the difference between 4G and 5G? And, you know, virtually nothing.
Yeah.
And like, what is actually going on here?
It's like a frequency range and power output. Yeah, that's all the difference is.
So it's a small thing. And which, you know, leads to enormously improved sort of internet speed, which is awesome. But like even me, like I'm the person who should be the most skeptical, the most inured against this sort of thing. And yet the repeat exposure on Twitter, on Facebook started, you know,
started raising curiosities, right?
Yeah, exactly. You start to get concerned, right?
Yeah.
And then if you haven't done any research on it, and most people won't, you're going to keep this residual fear. So if, let's say, somebody tries to put a 5G tower outside, I might be like, ugh.
It's like the new what do they call them?
The windmills,
yeah. That big windmill conspiracy.
Exactly. So you start to think like, I don't want that. Like, I don't know, but just to be safe, could we not? Like, could we move it somewhere else?
Yeah.
And so
it gets a stink starts developing.
That's actually a great analogy. It starts to stink.
Yeah.
And to cleanse your palate of that, you know, you have to sit down and do some real research and think it through. And there's a lot of pitfalls in doing that research. And so that's really what I want to emphasize about this is like that stink can be generated in so many ways. And, you know, that doubt can start to creep in. And that's just familiarity.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, you know, that's, everyone is vulnerable to that. Maybe I'm not a psychologist. Like, I do some degree of political psychology. I do political science.
Yeah.
But I am somewhat familiar with the literature, and there's sort of like different motivations for conspiratorial thinking. So like one that we could sort of talk about is social. And I think this is like a very strong influencer in the United States, but where your social identity gets caught up with a belief or an idea. So in the United States, you know, your Republican identity gets your like resistance to this stuff gets confused by your Republican identity. So you're a Republican, so you support the president who is saying that hydroxychloroquine will work. Okay, so your identity might
not
be
just that. There's also the small government component to republicanism and anti-government and Second Amendment stuff and
So your social identity becomes enormously important. And political scientists have studied this. Like there's some amazing research that shows, for example, like physicians in the United States who meet with patients, Republicans and Democrats respond differently to like birth control or to gun ownership or to like health concerns around these issues. And they take more or less time to talk about them. So like this affects large parts of our life when you have a very strong partisan identity. There's also like existential questions about like safety and control. So this gets like to that 5G tower. Like if you're concerned about the 5G tower, you want to keep yourself and your family safe, right? And you will do everything you can to make that happen. And so when you start to feel like you've lost control, like you are unsafe, you are more prone to start to believe in conspiracies or different ideas. You don't like to lose that locus of control. And the reality about the virus is that it has completely stripped away control of an enormous number of Canadians.
Yeah.
People have lost their job and have been at home. I've been very fortunate to be able to work from home during the pandemic, but I cannot imagine several months of doing that, trapped up inside. You know, you've lost total control of your life, your identity, your pride in your work gets stripped away from you by a government. And so that feeling might cause you to turn towards, what is the government doing? They're trying to control me. They're trying to, you know, disempower me. I feel disempowered. Somebody must have done that to me.
Yeah.
So that's sort of the existential. And then there's like this, I talked a little bit about it, the epistemic understanding. So this is trying to construct an internally valid version of the world. Right. And people like clarity. And I think this can't be overstated. Like, how do you explain, if you're not familiar with government, you're not familiar with media, you're not familiar with sort of the complexity of this, how do you explain the change in mask perspective? How do you explain that, you know, bars are open, but schools are closed or daycares are closed? Like, how do you explain some of these inconsistencies? Well, it's just control. It's because the science isn't consistent. It's too complicated. I can't figure it out. There's a clearer explanation, and I've found it. And so you lead to conspiratorial thinking. And so these are some of the like the well documented psychological mechanisms underlying this. And I mean, there's some great psychologists in the Canadian context doing work on this that really have been able to explore, and whose work I've read to help inform my understanding of this.
So the fear of what's happening leads to a feeling like you need to develop some level of control over the situation, and conspiracies are a kind of low nutrition diet way of doing that.
That's definitely part of it. Yeah.
And I always I use the example of someone who is afraid of flying. They're not actually afraid of flying. They're in an environment where they don't have control over an airplane or their destiny. It's basically tied up with someone who's locked away in a box at the front of the plane who they never see throughout the whole flight. And if they were actually flying the plane, they would probably feel a lot more comfortable themselves, because now they've regained control over their own life, even though they might not be able to fly the plane.
So I have a great example of this. So I did skydiving many years ago, and when you go up in the plane, it's the worst feeling. You're in this like car. It's a car. It's just rickety and kind of like bouncing up.
Yeah,
I hated it.
Screams death.
It screams death. And then, you know, you're getting out, you're going to jump, you've got your parachute, like you jump out, and it's terrifying, but sort of like exhilarating. That's why you do it. And then you pull the cord. And when you pull the cord, you regain control. And so you're up in the air, you're, you know, whatever, a kilometer up, 2 kilometers up, 3 kilometers up. And you're not safe, really, in the sense that
you're still 3,000 meters.
You're not where a human is supposed to be.
Yeah.
But you suddenly regain that control. And that moment is the best moment of skydiving. If anyone wants to go skydiving, that moment where you suddenly get control and you can move, and you're like, oh, I'm in control of my life again, even though you're in a very potentially dangerous situation.
Yeah.
Although once your parachute opens, it's statistically negligible. It's not a place to be. And so you've regained that control. And so that's a personal example. But I think that you can see this all in all walks of life. Control is nice.
So in the you touched on this a little bit earlier. In the American context, obviously the anti-mask movement and the misinformation ecosystem there is just a lot stronger. I don't know, just from first perceptions. Compared to Canada, why do you think that is? Do you think it's that general thing where Canadians get their identity from how we compare ourselves to the U.S. and we see the ridiculousness of stuff going on down there, which makes the whole anti-mask thing less tasteful, or we're more averse to adopting that because we see how the ridiculous consequences of it there and its ties to Trump and all that kind of stuff? Do you think it's that where, you know, we gain our Canadian identity from not being the Americans? Or is there something else at play there other than that in terms of the Canadian context versus the U.S.?
So I'm going to give a political scientist answer, which is that political elite cues are incredibly important during times like this. And I think the major difference...
Explain what Canada, that is for the,
yeah,
for the audience.
Yeah, yeah. So the major difference between Canada and the United States is these political elite cues. So people, especially those who have strong partisan identity, are very responsive to their political leaders. Our political leaders are the most visible faces during a situation like this. And what they say is hugely consequential for people who feel that they can trust them and that they matter. And so if you trust Justin Trudeau and he says something, you're far more likely to believe it.
Right.
So in the Canadian context, and we had a paper out at the Canadian Journal of Political Science early on about this, there was a remarkable cross-partisan consensus in the Canadian context on the severity of the virus once we got there. It did take us a bit of time, and about the need for dramatic government action, both in terms of like social distancing and also government intervention. There was like an enormous cross-partisan response that is virtually unheard of. It's very rare that Canadian parties all agree on a particular issue.
Mm-hmm.
And so you were getting the same elite cues regardless of whether or not you were an NDP, a conservative, a liberal, a green, a bloc. Everyone was saying the same thing. And that like unified political front is like a very powerful political force and could go a very long way. You had the exact opposite in the United States, where you had very strong elite cues with very divergent recommendations and explanations and all sorts of things. So that elite cue difference is important. You see this on other issues like climate change, where Canadians are much less divided than the United States on climate change, because in the United States, there is again these politically elite cues. Now, there is this interesting question about, you know, are politicians responding to their electorate, or is their electorate responding to the politician? And right. Of course, with causal questions like this, it's both ways. Absolutely.
Well, they say politics is downstream from culture, right? So
it is, but it also sometimes isn't. I think, you know, you might Trump
you
is
think
a,
because
is a good,
of the speed of this, it was it's
it, yeah,
it
this,
might have
the
been the other way
it.
Around.
And just always politicians are agents that are consequential. Like I think that you cannot be deterministic about the world and say culture determined that this politician would be like this, and then they are simply responding. Trump is like a singularly unique character, right? Trudeau, similarly, you know, has his perspective and his understanding of the world. And
I remember going through the political science and the individual theory to political outcomes was completely, they told us to ignore that because it'll never happen where the whim of this one individual will, you know, it's systems and governments and administrations. And now we're seeing the example that proves the opposite. Sorry, it was just a sideline. I just remember I heard as soon as Trump got elected, I heard in some of his stuff, I heard my political science professors, you know, echoing that thing and I was you were
there
wrong.
There are competing theories. Yeah, you were wrong. There are competing theories about this and there's evidence for and against, but there have been incredibly influential people in history who have changed political outcomes. Now, did they change them, you know, in big picture? Well, that's a hard question to answer.
Right.
But living through the moment, it's very hard not to feel like they are enormously influential. And for sure, on the day to day, it matters. So I think that's one of the reasons the Canadian American, just to sort of get back to the Canadian American distinction, the elite cues, I think, have really mattered. There's also this, we are, Canada is well connected to the United States and the world, but we are less connected than the United States. The United States has many international cities that have people flying in from all over the world. And mm-hmm. I mean, New York was so incredibly hard hit, but also New York is a major hub city where people were flying in from all over the world and quickly spread the virus throughout the population.
Yeah.
And so that's also part of it. I think there is a tendency for like a Canadian smugness, but Canada has yep. not done that well. Like, it just has not. And we have strong conspiracy beliefs, and we have large protests, and we have large, like, we have massive misperceptions. We look very beautiful next to the United States.
Yeah.
But it is a very low bar. And we really shouldn't be comparing ourselves just to the United States. We should be comparing ourselves to other countries, Australia, New Zealand, United Kingdom, Germany, you know, other countries with our resources at their disposal yep. who have been able to do this better than us.
Yeah, and that was actually something I kept saying in the early stages of this. And, you know, friends would be saying, yeah, look at the U.S., look at the U.S. At least Canada's not the U.S. I'm like, we're still in full lockdown. We have collapsed our economy. No one's working. We are, you know, the Treasury, the central bank is doling out money that we may or may not have or be able to recoup. We are not in any different position. We might be in a different position politically, but we're not in any kind of different position than the U.S. on this compared to a place like some of the countries you mentioned. Or even, again, I came from Taiwan on the 15th.
Yeah.
Taiwan has a comparable economic resources and development to Canada and a comparable population. It doesn't have as many international airports, but it's, you know, 90 miles from or 100 miles from the coast of mainland China. I mean, they were right next to the beast, and
yeah.
they never went into full lockdown. And, you know, you cannot explain that to your average Canadian because, again, of this Canadian smugness comparing ourselves to the U.S. So I agree with you 100% on that. So this brings us... So the political context is super important in terms of combating misinformation or perpetuating misinformation. Given your average person really doesn't... I mean, can be exposed to this even when they are scientifically literate... and media literate, where do you think solutions lie here? I mean, at the end of the day, we touched on the idea that, you know, your average person doesn't stand a chance against a lot of this stuff, and there's always going to be a portion of the population that adopts these attitudes whole hog. Is the solution just greater legislation? Is it enacting antitrust on the U.S. part to break up some of these companies to better control them? Where do you think this lies?
Yeah, so I'll first talk about, like, from a social science perspective, and then yes. I can speculate about some, like, broader things. But on the social science perspective, there's, like, an army of political scientists, psychologists, communication specialists trying to figure out, like, how do you combat misinformation? What prompts work? Like, what flags? You know, if you flag content on social media and you say, like, this contains misleading facts. If you censor, you know, like, there's all these different approaches. One of the ones that I find very interesting and I think is very practical is that there's some good evidence coming out from a Canadian scholar at Regina who shows that people are actually reasonably good at discerning between fake and real information. They're actually not bad at it. But that typically when you are consuming social media, you don't think. You don't actually take a second to reflect and consider the source or whatever. You find something and you share it, you like it, you retweet it, you forward it, whatever, without having actually done the critical thinking that is required. And this scholar's recommendation, and I sort of really, you know, the evidence is very good, to just take a second, particularly on social media, and say, like, do I trust this source? Is it consistent? Is it is it like consistent with more like mainstream perspective, or can I find a second source that is that looks like from a reputable website? Yeah, with an owner that, you know, I can point to somebody and say this is the person propagating this belief, and that second greatly reduces the likelihood that somebody's going to share a fake piece of news. People can discern, but they just don't care that much, I think, is one of the findings of this research, which is frustrating and surprising to some extent, that people can discriminate but just don't choose not to. But it's because social media is such a visceral, fast-paced environment that people just are doing this
designed deliberately that way.
Designed deliberately, absolutely. So for sort of everyday people, just taking a second on social media is good. I think more generally, I think a humility in all of this, you know, and it's something that I think scientists are trained to do, is to assume that something is not true until there's good evidence to say that it is true. Mm-hmm. And so I think that evidence seeking and really actually just being a little bit more humble about what you're saying, about what the people you're listening to are saying, and realize that nobody knows that much about any single thing.
Right.
You know, people are experts and they can know a lot about a very specific area, but that evidence might change. They might be wrong in a month, in 2 months, and that, you know, we should just calm down a little about this stuff. I think that that's sort of at an individual level. Now, the bigger question is, like, you know, how as a society can we try to work around the very clear dangerous effects of misinformation, particularly on social media? And this question has begun to be answered by social media companies themselves during this pandemic in a way that they have never done before, in terms of censoring content, adding flags, trying to address this issue. But one of the things that's really scary to me is that we have left it more or less up to social media companies to self-regulate and self-control on their platforms. Every single large publicly important good has a regulatory body: energy, communications, healthcare, education. There are standards, there is a professional organization, there's real thought given into government regulation. We have utterly failed to do so in the social media space, astonishingly so. And we're living through that right now, where Facebook will go in front of a congressional committee and say, you know, we have 35,000 content checkers and we're doing the best that we can. But fundamentally, we believe in free speech. And they can say that, and more or less, they can get away with it.
Yeah.
But imagine a media company doing that. Imagine, you know, the Toronto Star deciding that it was going to start publishing whatever it wanted, free from government regulation, free from a public interest. People would be up in arms, because there was a society-wide contract that we know that something like energy, something like the information we consume, needs to be at least protected from grift and protected from con people and protected from people who want to use it to manipulate us and to control us.
All freedoms have limitations, and you know, the media space, even if there is a general consensus that freedom of speech is good, there needs to be still regulation on it. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, Facebook tends to hide behind the regulation that they're a platform. They're not a media company. And so
which is just an absurd farce at this point. Just to be clear, they have gobbled up basically all, you know, all ad revenue online is now contained in several of these large conglomerates. They are producing news. They are controlling what is on their platform. They are censoring today. They are. Like, anyone who's like, no, it's, you shouldn't censor because they'll just, it's the private market and people, they are too big and they are doing it themselves. And they are doing it like the robber barons of the 40s, you know.
And they know that they're doing it. And I only say that because I don't know if you're familiar with Recode Decode with Kara Swisher. She is she's a media commentator, and she's also an early venture capitalist in that world, in the Silicon Valley world. She's been heavily critical of Facebook on this, and she's interviewed Mark Zuckerberg, and she knows internally they do not care. They see their mission as being acknowledging that there's an issue, but not just generally, there's a culture of not giving a crap about the consequences of what they're doing. move fast and break things. That's their ethos. So you're suggesting that the legislated regulation can be one of the prongs of a solution here. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. I think that every, again, every major public interest industry is regulated. Doctors are regulated. Should we not regulate doctors because we think, oh, you know, doctors, the free market should be able to discriminate between like medical practitioners and non-medical practitioners? We live in a society where we have constructed a way for us to be safe together, to live together, and to protect each other from grift.
Yeah.
And social media companies are the latest there. I think that one of the other things that's important about this is that social media companies have taken important steps in these spaces. Twitter has been sort of a leader in this and it is doing this. But again, they are self-regulating. And this sort of like voluntary self-regulation is a really like is an effective and historically documented corporate strategy. We say, yes, we will give you some look at what we're doing. Look at what we're doing. Because the effort is to not be regulated, is to not have any degree of control over their operations. So they voluntarily self-regulate, but only to the point that they want to. And I mean, people can call me a big government guy, but we do this for every other industry. And the fact that we don't do it for social media when it is such an important part of our lives and really the single largest thing that people spend their time on.
Yeah.
And we don't care.
In the U.S., where they have this very much a greater ethos of free enterprise. And this is largely an American problem because a lot of these companies are American-based and American-regulated. And at the end of the day, the internet is an American invention, largely. So it's incumbent upon them to kind of take the lead on this stuff, and they just don't because of this free enterprise attitude. But again, you see the consequences of it happening. And I agree with you. There needs to be some body of regulation, and I'm not even sure in the worldwide space of information how you are able to even regulate things from country to country. I mean, you can do it via IP address, but there are
well, I'll give you an example.
Go ahead.
I'll give you an example. During the last Canadian federal election, there were much, much stricter control around advertising on social media platforms. And
I know
Google,
I got in crap for having a Facebook ad in the last campaign. I got a crap for having a Facebook ad run over by like 4 hours.
Okay. So yeah, there you go. So there was Google pulled out. They did not run election ads at all during the campaign. I ran lots of ads on Facebook and Twitter, just recruiting people for research. And there were strict controls around what could be done. We did some research on the ads that were shared. There was a degree of transparency. It like everything else that these social media companies do in terms of access for academics, it is of varying quality. But they did it. They regulated it. Like I understand that there's this existential problem. Like, are they too big? Will they just leave our country? Will they? No, the market is too large. They will like every other company. They will have to. They will fight it tooth and nail.
They did fight it tooth and nail. I remember when they were being called to Parliament to one of the committees. Facebook, they essentially ignored the order.
Yeah, and absolutely. They will fight it. Absolutely.
So they have an arrogance about them. There needs to be some level of crackdown, given they are the new Robert Barons of our era of the information age.
Yeah, yeah, and the exact solution of that, you know, I'm not an antitrust lawyer, but there clearly has been a consolidation that is particularly in the media environment that is unheard of, and we would not be okay with two media companies alone controlling the entirety of the information we consume.
Yeah.
I mean, our anti-monopoly laws would prevent that, but that's what's happened on social media.
Do you think it's a generational issue in that because the information is age and the social media age specifically is so young still, and it came so fast and so quick. I remember creating my first Twitter account for a politician in 2008, and they were like, what the hell is this for? Why do I have to bother with this? And meanwhile, fast forward just, you know, few years later, and it's now deciding elections, this one tool. So you can imagine the legislators, they just they would maybe like to regulate it, but they're not familiar with the consequences. They didn't grow up with it. Whereas, you know, a factory or an industry robber baron might be easier to understand. So do you think when people who have grown up with this and see the consequences of it get into positions of power and are able to legislate, perhaps solutions will come then? I hold that hope. What are your thoughts on that?
There was a great moment during the big tech hearings about a month ago where I forget the Congress person who asked this, the congressman, but basically was asking Mark Zuckerberg about YouTube censoring something. And yeah. Mark responded, well, that's Google. And like that lack of literacy amongst legislators is absolutely a problem.
And also gets people, the general public who are familiar with it, rooting for Mark Zuckerberg, because these elderly statesmen are essentially, they have no idea what they're talking about. It's like that one politician from Alaska talking about, you know, the internet's a series of tubes. You know, that old thing, right? Like, it's essentially that writ large. They go out, so it makes Zuckerberg look like Tony Stark, you know, going up against Congress.
Yeah, and that's actually not a good visual. That scene in the Iron Man movie, absolutely. Yeah. The other thing I think here is that the social media companies themselves probably were very slow, or have been slow, to even understand that there was a real problem in what they were doing. I mean, there's been like, particularly on YouTube is a really good example, where there was this like desire to maximize time on the platform, and there wasn't the thought given to the downstream consequences of that. This is particularly like the early days of YouTube, when these algorithms were being developed. Like, they were just trying to get a good product out there, and there was not that like level of social responsibility. And so, you know, to place the blame on the Zuckerbergs of the world is to, I think, miss the point. Like, they were trying to create a product that would enrich themselves, you know, and change the world maybe, but mostly enrich themselves. And they were incredibly successful to do that. And it hit them like a brick wall in 2016 that their platforms were suddenly being used for all sorts of damaging and dangerous things. And so, you know, they've had some time to respond and are trying to figure it out. I'm not an apologist for social media companies, but I think, I hope that they themselves realize that their degree of self-regulation is completely insufficient. There was this high-profile case in India linking sort of Facebook operations in India to Modi's support, and these things are happening. You know, like there are enormous issues, and so I mean, something has to be done there. It's interesting because, you know, this has been a long conversation, and we've sort of moved from like this very specific empirical finding to this like broader question of Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and TikTok now is a real challenge.
Oh my God, the TikTok debate. I'm having a lot of fights over that one.
Yeah, for sure. I do kind of want to add one more layer to this, which is that these companies are incredibly non-transparent. Twitter, which has the best access tool for research, so you always see research on Twitter because Twitter provides the best data access for researchers, is still limited. And the data I have with like a paid Twitter like pipeline, like, you know, doing my best to get that, like, really familiar with that work, is a tiny fraction of what their internal staff is able to access. And that difference means that academic researchers and those who are trying to understand this stuff do not have the access that is required. There was a truly astonishing example 2 weeks ago, where there was this happened on Twitter. There was a post about how all of the top pages circulating on Facebook were from right wing news sites like Breitbart, and one of the Facebook leads replied on Twitter saying, "Okay, yes, you know, I don't want to cast doubt on your research, but just so you know, what you are using, which is the CrowdTangle platform that Facebook provides for researchers, provides only engagement data. That's not actually that's not the same as views," was basically this person's argument. And the whole academic community was like, wait a second, you've given us this thing, and now you're saying this thing is not valid. And they will happily do that. And there's like this, we're looking into giving real access. And this is a bit of inside baseball, but this just goes to show the complete inability of academic researchers to really understand these phenomena.
Do you think really that that's where that's a point where government can step in and say the open data portals for these platforms need to provide real world data points that are significant and salient, because otherwise it leads to misinformed conclusions by researchers.
Absolutely. Yeah. How do you regulate something you don't understand?
Yeah.
I mean, this is not a problem of an old senator or an old congressman. This is the problem of even the academic community struggles with. The different companies have experimented with like internal research teams, and this is sort of another possibility. But internal research teams are bound by all sorts of constraints, and that might not be the preferred kind of way to do it. There's a high-profile political scientist named Gary King who's partnered with Facebook to give sort of unprecedented access. And the first public release came out, and it's from data that dated over a two-year period, but several years ago. You're like, well, okay. Like,
what's the
Facebook algorithm has changed since then. Like, what, you know, we're playing with old news. You know, this is obviously, I'm interested in better data access. Like,
in your interest to have access to better data, because it really does, you know, from a political science standpoint, but even from a sociological standpoint, the well-being of society, we rely on data like this in order to inform us and inform our regulators to push forward in certain directions. If you're getting data that's either irrelevant or leads you down the wrong rabbit hole, then it's contrary to the goals of having the data in the first place. And I find that reprehensible.
Yeah. Yeah. There's been a real shift in social science to open science, to replicability, to sort of that that anyone can check their work. Right. And social media companies are not interested in that. And that's sort of deeply frustrating and absolutely damaging to the public conversation. And you could see government regulation work. So, you know, we had this ad library. That was the first time. It was new. It had some bugs in the API endpoint. But, like, you know, more or less we got some degree of data and were able to comment. But to give you an example, there would be like a range. You'd get like how much money was spent on this. It was like $1 to $25,000. Well, okay, like that's a big difference.
Huge difference.
That is like an order of magnitude different for this ad. How do I know what actually happened? And of course, you don't know. And so, there needs to be better data access.
Is there caginess because they know if the reality comes out, there'll be greater regulator? Is there caginess because it undermines their sales pitch to people who will throw ad revenue? What do you suspect is the case?
Your statement there just made me think of like Cambridge Analytica. I don't know if people remember the Cambridge Analytica scandal, but one of the things is the CEO was pitching this as like this incredible insight tool that like would really precise what everyone wanted. And it was based on sort of a psychological big five personality traits. And the pitch was totally out of line with what they were actually technically able to do. And I think that, yes, social media companies are to some extent, like that. They are incredibly sophisticated, but maybe not as sophisticated and magical as we think they are. So there might be something. I mean, there is also an argument for proprietary knowledge, right? The algorithmic, there is a value to their algorithm.
Yeah.
That is their core business model. And so protecting that is understandable. And I, you know, if that's how you make all your money, you'd be resistant to help an academic reverse engineer it.
Yeah.
And I understand that. But there are some questions which are not about that, or many questions that, you know, should be better understood. And we just don't, you know, we're just not able to get that in a meaningful way right now.
If you're a regulator out there or a politician in a current position to do something about it, please make notes from this podcast. And I'm going to include a lot of the notes that we're discussing in the show notes below. Angus, this has been incredibly insightful, and I really appreciate you coming on. But before we end off, I want to know a little bit more about the Media Ecosystem Observatory. Can you explain to us a little bit about that? And I find it kind of curious because I came across that reading the paper and some of the dialogue that was happening around it.
Yeah, I mean, thank you for the opportunity to talk about the research institute that I'm part of. So the Media Ecosystem Observatory is a partnership between computer science, communications, and political science at McGill in Toronto, McGill University and University of Toronto. It's funded primarily by Canadian Heritage. And the purpose of it is to sort of evaluate the health of the Canadian information ecosystem, particularly around misinformation, and to help inform the public conversation about that. So, you know, we do research on a whole range of topics. This project kind of falls under that. We look at other things like, you know, we mentioned or we talked earlier about the research on sort of cross-partisan consensus. We looked at like government information sharing patterns and like effectiveness of government information sharing around COVID-19. But we, you know, you can check us out on online, mediaecosystemobservatory.com, and sort of our research papers are up there. And basically we try to do kind of like world-class focused on Canada research on the information ecosystem. And because there really was that hole in the Canadian context where there just isn't.
Absolutely.
There isn't that rich understanding of traditional media, social media, and how that affects sort of minds and behaviors in Canada. So that's what we do.
That's awesome. And I was very glad to actually come across it because I think it's an excellent endeavor and an excellent project. And if there are ways that people can support it, they can go to the website and check it out. And I really appreciate that you guys are dedicating that level of work to ensuring that our media ecosystem remains a little bit healthier, even if it moves the needle in just a slight direction. I hope that's the case. And also it can be a central repository for elected leadership and regulators to go and find out exactly what's going on. And I'm glad to have someone as astute as you involved in that project. So Angus, I really appreciate you coming on today. This has been an excellent conversation, and I will not hesitate to bring you back on again in perhaps another context, and perhaps a better context in terms of this stuff. And for those all interested in the actual study that Angus helped co-author, I'm going to link that as well in the show notes below, and you can check it out there. Angus, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. This has been a real pleasure, and I think the format has been awesome. We do media, and it's 15-second spots, and you're not able to have this rich conversation that really kind of explores these themes. So it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much, and don't forget to tell your friends about us, because I'm always interested in having topics like this fleshed out in a long-form format. If you know anyone who has some interesting studies, please feel free to recommend them, and I will definitely bring them on and run through them the same way we did this. So I really appreciate having you as an asset to the Pod6 Network and Lockdown Toronto show specifically. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks. Bye.
And to those who are tuned in online, if you are listening to this in audio, you can obviously watch a lot of this in video on YouTube and Facebook. And if you are watching this on YouTube or Facebook, you can also check it out in audio format. Just search Lockdown Toronto in whatever podcatcher you're using. And if you're online anywhere, just look for the Pod6 Network. If you have any comments or suggestions, you can always email us info@pod6.com. That's info@pod6ix.com. Thank you for tuning in, and we'll check you out in the next one.